Good morning. I'm Jim Brown. You're listening to the summer edition of The Current. Scott Carney has spent several years following a trail of bodies, or at least parts of bodies. He's a journalist who's been investigating the international trade in organs, bones, blood, and even living people that are bought and sold on the global market. His new book is called The Red Market, On the Trail of the World's Organ Brokers, Bone Thieves, Blood Farmers, and Child Traffickers. Scott Carney is in Culver City, California. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Jim.
Let's start by defining the red market. How would you describe it?
Well, in my book, what I'm looking at every way that the body is bought and sold legally and illegally in the world. And what I see as what I call a red market is, you know, everything from kidneys to bones to blood to human eggs and surrogate pregnancies and even whole adopted children. And what makes it different than other markets is that when you're buying and selling the human body, you have this double speak in language where on one level you say that the body's being given altruistically. These are donations.
Right.
These are things that are good. And on the other side, you're also exchanging cold, hard cash. And that's really the crux of what I'm looking at in this book.
Now, I understand there are a couple of things that happened to you in your life, a couple of specific incidents that triggered your interest in this.
It was a long developing process, starting with me as a graduate student at University of Wisconsin when I was trying to get my PhD in anthropology. And I actually was broke, and I joined a clinical trial for Viagra.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, not Viagra. It's a relative of Viagra called Levitra by Bayer. And I was locked in a room with 30 guys on these erectile dysfunction drugs. And at the time, I thought it was sort of funny that I was getting paid to do this. And I met all these people who were actually professional guinea pigs. They would go from trial to trial to trial in the United States and in Europe. And they'd make about $60,000 a year doing it. And I was fascinated by the fact that this was going on. This was an industry. And I wrote a couple articles about that.
Mm-hmm.
And in short order, after picking up my check for renting my own body out, I went full time into journalism, and I jumped ship and I moved to where my field site was as an anthropologist, which is India, and I began writing and researching there.
And while you were doing that, you were also shepherding, I guess, American students through a bit of a semester in India process where you had another incident occur.
Right. And that's actually the second way that the book started for me is, initially my job there was I was both a journalist and I was leading these abroad programs.
Mm-hmm.
And I had about 15 students, I believe. And we went from Delhi to Varanasi to the holy city of Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha attained enlightenment. And after a 10-day meditation retreat, one of my students died tragically in what we believe is a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And I was all of a sudden in this incredibly harrowing experience. I was suddenly responsible for another person's body. And out of the woodwork, I realized that there were so many people interested in expressing their own agency over her corpse. There were police who were looking at first as a murder investigation. There were coroners. There were insurance companies trying to pay as little as possible to ship the body back home. The parents, the abroad program, and all of a sudden, her body went from being something that she has total control over to something that everyone else has control and stakes.
Mm-hmm.
in her corpse. And in sort of a very one of the things that was difficult for me is I was trying to keep her body fresh so that she could, to preserve it so that she could actually be put on a plane and be returned home. And I ended up having to take photos of her body for insurance and legal reasons, and it was so strange to have this, who was one of my students, a 21-year-old lady, mm-hmm. And I'm suddenly being asked to photograph her body at the request of her parents, her naked, body and all these wounds, and it's a very sort of intimate and disturbing event. And I realized that that there's this just tenuously thin line between the way we control our body, and it's just this life and death, and just everything changes at that moment.
We become a thing, or I guess in terms that you write, a series or a sequence of commodities, all of them with a value.
Yeah, right. And you suddenly see yourself as, the body is, while we're alive, it's just this vibrant thing. Maybe it has a soul. It's somewhat special. And then as a corpse, you're just a jumble of matter. You're an object. And very quickly, you become an object that has real world value.
And people, you put a value on your own body. Tell us the figure that you've come up with. How much are you worth?
I open the book suggesting that I'm worth about $250,000 if you rended all of my flesh from my bones, sold my kidneys, my heart, blood, thyroid gland, you name it. I think I could probably get about $250,000 for my body.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've got a lot of very strange, very different stories about the Red Market in this book. Is there one discovery you made that shocked you more than any other?
My book is just full of unintuitive and shocking tales. But there was this one moment in India when I was on the Nepal-India border searching for illegal markets in human blood, where I found people, because blood had become commercialized and criminalized in this village, not a village, actually, a city called Gorakhpur, people were actually kidnapping, this former dairy farmer was kidnapping people and locking them in basically a cow shed and draining their blood forcibly. And he would keep them there for 3 years at a time. Once he had sort of drained their blood, he kept them minimally conscious and just milked them like cows to keep the local blood supply pumping in this region of the world. And it's just one of these things where you can't believe that there's so much possible horror in the world. Mm-hmm. And what was even more shocking than that is that the profit margins weren't even big. I mean, he was only getting like $25 per pint of blood to perpetrate one of the worst crimes I've ever even imagined.
And the only reason they found out was that one of these fellows, even though he was severely weakened by this, managed to escape.
Yeah, I mean, one day this dairy farmer person had forgotten to padlock the door, and this guy managed to hobble out onto a chai stand where there were these farmers sitting, and he was like, I'm being sucked dry by this vampire. And they rescued 17 people after the police came. And these people were so perilously endangered that they had become addicted to giving blood. If they had just let them regenerate their blood supply, these people would have died from having too much oxygen in their blood.
They wouldn't have been able to handle the oxygen. Yeah.
That's right.
Is this an isolated incident, or does it say something more about the demand that I guess all of us fuel for blood?
Well, blood is one of the most valuable commodities out there. As far as red markets go, it's probably the single most lucrative market in the world. The Red Cross sells about $3 billion worth of blood every year, both domestically and internationally. And the United States is a net blood exporter. You hear about all these blood drives where we say there's a shortage of blood. And while that's true globally, in the States, it's not. We actually sell a lot of blood to Canada and to Italy and to India and to just really all around the world.
So,
and as for whether these blood farmers, how frequent that is, I'm hoping that this is an extreme incident.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things like it in every Indian city. You can definitely find people willing to sell their blood against the law. And, it's unregulated and it's dangerous. And I'm sure there are other blood farmers out there as well, but hopefully not a lot of them.
Tell us about Kidneyville.
So when I was living in India, I was living on the southern side, on the right side of India, in a city called Chennai. It used to be called Madras. And after the tsunami, I think it was, 2004, 2005 tsunami?
Mm-hmm. I think it was Christmas 2004.
Right, that's right. This giant tidal wave crashes on the Indian coast, and hundreds of thousands of people are almost instantly homeless. And the way the international community responded was to create different refugee camps, and you know, that you sort of collect the farmers and to one place and build them concrete huts and that sort of thing. One of these places, called Tsunami Nagar in Chennai, was only a couple kilometers from where I lived in Chennai, and within probably 6 months of the tsunami, organ brokers descended on this village and really convinced just about all the women to sell their kidneys to local hospitals. And when I had arrived, the village had actually the name had unofficially been changed from Tsunami Nagar, which is the place where the tsunami refugees lived, to Kidney Vakam, the place where you can go get a cheap kidney. Mm-hmm. And you know, you go there and there were at least 80 women who had all sold their kidneys, and you could just see, because you know the way the sari works, and they all wear saris, is that their midriff is exposed, and you can see these huge incision scars on all the women there.
How much were they getting for their kidneys?
Well, the brokers generally, I mean, it's illegal to sell their kidneys, but, you know, there's incentives there. And the brokers would usually offer them probably between $2,000 and $4,000 for their kidneys. They'd give half up front and half after the surgery, but the half after surgery was never given. So they're only given about usually between $800 and, I guess, about $1,300.
Right? And what would drive the women to do this?
Just desperate poverty. I mean, these people had been put in these refugee camps and then more or less forgotten by the international community. And, you know, after these sorts of natural disasters around the world, you see different brokers, organ brokers and child brokers just descend on areas. I mean, think about what happened in Haiti. The mm-hmm. earthquake hit there. And then there are all these Christian groups who went there and they're trying to rescue children who are orphaned. But then there were also incidences of people trying to more or less steal children and sell them on the international adoption market, which is another thing that I explore in my book.
Now, these kidneys, where would they have ended up?
A lot of it's for the domestic population in India. There were also incidences of people coming from Sri Lanka, the United States, from Canada.
Now, I'd like to go back a little bit and talk some more about your own experience as a human guinea pig. We have, in part, you to thank for the fact that doctors now know how much Viagra is too much to prescribe to people. What did you discover about the pharmaceutical testing that's going on around the world?
Well, first and foremost, I found that 30 milligrams of Levitra will give me a headache.
But along with other things.
Along with other things, you know, but one of definitely a headache was involved, and I think that was one of their big breakthroughs, I guess, in the research. But what happens is there's this global pharmaceutical industry that you know, obviously we all are enjoying the fruits of, from everything from antibiotics to, you know, thyroid medication to anti-rejection drugs to really just, you know, diabetes medication, you name it. It's been gone through clinical testing. And naturally, in order to test, you need to find people who are willing to give their body to science, either mm-hmm. through just pure altruism or, more likely, through money.
Right.
And I found that there's this whole class of people who, you know, consider themselves human guinea pigs, or, you know, sometimes they call themselves lab rats. And they'll just hop from clinical trial to clinical trial to clinical trial to clinical trial, testing every drug you can imagine. And this can be a dangerous career option. Mm-hmm. A couple of people have died. One, you know, sort of famous example, a guy named Jerry Gelsinger in Philadelphia, who was testing a gene therapy cocktail, and he died during the trial. And there's, you know, other incidences of this, but you know, these are you know, untested drugs. That's why they're testing them, and some people are being exposed to a fair amount of danger. Now, what's happening recently, in the last, I'd say about 10 years, is that to bring a drug to market takes oftentimes $1 billion from the very first, you know, incidence of research all the way to like when it's released, about $1 billion. You can cut costs tremendously if you take those clinical trials outside of North America and mm-hmm. Europe and test them in India and China and certain places in Africa, because you have still great medical facilities in these countries. But you have people who are willing to sell their flesh much cheaper,
right?
As well. So, and one of the problems in these other countries is that the regulation is even poorer there. And you know, there's grave fears that we're testing drugs on people and causing them undue risk because of that.
Well, you write about a group of people who were HIV positive who were used to test AIDS medication that even if it was approved, they wouldn't ever be able to afford anyway.
And that's the most common. That's true of just every clinical trial. Is that, you know, just because you're testing the drug doesn't mean you're ever going to see the benefits of it,
right?
Especially if you're in one of the early phases of the trial.
Now, your book doesn't just deal with parts of our bodies; it also deals with entire complete bodies. You take a good long look at the dark side of international adoption. Tell us what you discovered there.
Well, in 1999, there was an orphanage in Chennai called Malaysian Social Services, which did hundreds of adoptions. And they had a huge number of children in the orphanage, mm-hmm. as you can imagine, more than a couple hundred. But they had no real way of funding these kids. So they started to see that international adoptions were quite lucrative. They could make about $8,000 for every child that they adopted out. And, you know, the orphanage that they coordinated with in the United States and Canada and Europe would get about would share that fee, and they would get another $8,000
right.
on their side. But one of the problems with orphanages is that children who are in them are often sick. They're developmentally disabled. They've been there for a little while, they're not very desirable. People don't really want to adopt them. So the orphanage got into this crux where they needed to provide a certain number of international adoptions to maintain their revenue, but they didn't have the product that people wanted.
Right.
So they began to kidnap children off of the streets. And between about 1996 and 2001, they did 160 adoptions abroad from kidnapped children. In 2007, I tracked down one of these children from Chennai to a house in the American Midwest, mm-hmm. Where some Christian family, who were very good people, thought they were helping, you know, rescue a child from abroad, but ended up basically purchasing a kidnapped children. And this is a rampant problem around the world. I already mentioned Haiti earlier, but, you know, there are in Congo, this is in Sudan, in Guatemala, in South Korea, China. This is a huge problem just because of the basic economics. We don't want to adopt sick children from abroad. We want cute, healthy, happy babies.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't get those babies from orphanages.
For every single transaction that you detail goes from someone of a lower class to someone of a higher class.
Right. And flesh always goes up the social pyramid. I mean, you don't find a lot of millionaires selling their kidneys. There might be some very rare cases of altruistic donations between family members or perhaps some Christian groups. But, you know, flesh goes up. It never goes down.
So what does that say about all of us, including the end consumer of this flesh?
Well, I mean, we're complicit in these red markets. I mean, I guess the thing that is most important to me in this book is that we have, even though we have this language of donation and this language of altruism, we still look at all of these things as commodities. We look at, you know, when you need a kidney and, you know, you have kidney failure, the doctor's going to come up to you and he's going to look at your chart and he's going to look very concerned. He's going to say, you know, let's say he was talking to me. Let's say he's talking to you. He's like, Jim, you're going to need a kidney or you're going to die. And, you know, And then the conversation just becomes just about that kidney. What he doesn't say to you is you're going to need someone else's kidney, mm-hmm. or you're going to die. And I think we need to really think about the supply chains, and that when you get a piece of human material, you really are indebted to another individual. It's not just some widget that exists in the ether that has no connection to another person. It's always coming from someone. That's the whole thing with human flesh. There's no great synthetic replacement yet that science has provided. If it's a commercial system or if it's an altruistic system like we have, I don't think that in a sense really matters. I mean, either way, these materials are going to move. What we need to do is reinscribe all the body part markets with true transparency. We need public records open for everyone to look at, you know, not just the family members and the recipient, but journalists and regulators and independent citizens. I think that it needs to be fully open and fully transparent. And that when you get that tissue or get that blood or get that kidney or human skeleton or whatever it is you're getting, you have to think about it not as a widget, but as something that comes from another person. And we have to keep that person in your mind that whole time. And if we can do that, I think that we can actually fix this system. So in a sense, I'm not against the commercialization of, say, kidneys or blood or whatever else. But we need to go transparency. That is far more important. We can also do it with the altruistic system. But again, we need transparency for that too.
So if right you receive now, a kidney, you know exactly where that kidney came from. If you adopt a child, you know exactly where that child came from. There are no mysteries.
Exactly. And right now we have, you know, the ethics of privacy are for some reason the thing that we hold dearest in the United States and in Canada and elsewhere. We think that the privacy of that donor individual and the recipient is the most important thing. But I say that's just not true. The most important thing is to be sure we're not doing atrocities. Be sure that people aren't dying needlessly for the tissue supply. And the only way to do that is to let the sun shine in on the overall market.
Is it also, I guess, on a larger scale, is it time to rethink our obsession with living longer?
Oh, that's hard. And I think that is such a hard question. In some ways, if our life is dependent on the death or the loss of health in another person, then yes, we need to reevaluate that. We need to think that our lives cannot be extended through our own or through being like vampires. That's just morally, ethically, and even economically just wrong. But, you know, I think that we should also do everything we can to, you know, increase public health. You know, if we think about how humanity has prolonged its life in the last 100 years, and we've had a 30-year increase in lifespan since 1901, we have to still push social programs, but maybe not depend so much on other humans, at least for their body parts.
Scott Carney, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it was so great to be here.
Scott Carney is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. His new book is The Red Market, On the Trail of the World's Organ Brokers, Bone Thieves, Blood Farmers, and Child Traffickers. Now, if you have thoughts on this or any other story you hear on The Current, let us know. You can send us an email. Just go to our website at cbc.ca/thecurrent, all one word, and click on the Contact Us link. You can also call us toll-free at 1-877-287-7366. That number once again, 1-877-287-7366. Stay with us. Coming up next on CBC Radio 1, it's Out of Their Minds, a look at exciting new ideas and inventions and the heretical thinkers behind them. And tonight at 10 o'clock on CBC Television, it's The National. I'm Jim Brown. Thanks for listening to the summer edition of The Current.
This day in history. On this day in 1812, the U.S. invades Canada at Windsor, Ontario, during the War of 1812. 199 years later, the U.S. no longer invades Canada, except through every radio station, TV channel, and movie theater.